long time. Their son and grandson, Curtis, we used to go to story time together even before we were in school. And he went to Waynesville and I went to Clint Massey, and then we worked at Der Dutchman for years together, so it's always good to see them. In preparing the lesson for this morning, I was always kicking around a few ideas, and especially when Cody was up here teaching, you know, sometimes things, when you have it laid out here in PowerPoint, doesn't necessarily work the way you want it to. You know, there's always these goof-ups or something that the computer does, and I was trying to put a lesson together that it was only me up here just speaking out of the Bible and putting a few things together. But when I sat down to do the lesson, I did the exact opposite. We're going to look at images today. Because what I was thinking is how we learn through visual learning. And what a great tool that we have to use today for these visual images. Because I think of how our brain relates certain images to certain words or phrases. So we're going to look at a few things here, and then we're going to maybe connect some words to their images. And hopefully that helps us when we're studying the Bible and building our knowledge on biblical things. So just to kind of give a synopsis of visual learning, I think we're probably all familiar with the different types of learning. It was started by a man with the last name of Fleming. He came up with the kinesthetic, auditory, and visual learning styles. So we have these basic forms of learning. They're kind of broken down into three basic forms. And today we're going to do visual learning, and I'm going to apologize because this is going to be recorded and put on the internet to the ones listening, because so much of this is going to be based on images and relaying images to certain words and phrases. I know that Roger and a few people had to head out this morning, and they all told me that they're going to listen to this online, so I said, good, but you might want me to send the PowerPoint over so you maybe click along with it so you can attach these few things here together. So we're going to look at these visual learning techniques. Visual learning to me is really important, and we'll kind of see here in just the topics where it talks about retention, reading comprehension, student achievement, thinking and learning skills, and critical thinking. All these are related to visual learning. And as some of you may know, here where it talks about students with or without learning disabilities improve achievements across content areas and grade levels, I do have a learning disability. I'm not exactly sure what it is. It's either dyslexia or some form of which. And what I normally tell people on how to relate what I see when I look at a piece of paper is if you look at a word search, that's about what it looks like to me. It doesn't piece together. The letters don't flow together. It looks like a word search. It looks like somebody just threw letters out on a piece of paper. So what I like is I like images. I like pictures, and I like to relate those things to those images. So I'm going to kind of explain what we're going to try to do here today. So when talking about retention, because we just discussed what retention was, it's where students remember information better and can better recall those things when you have a picture to kind of link that to. So to prove that you guys have already done this throughout your learning years, so what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of an elephant? Just, you've already thought of an elephant. Almost even before I said it, you probably already had an elephant in your mind. Like, even if I say, don't think of a zebra, you've already had an image of a zebra in your mind, even though I said not to think of a zebra. That's just how we learn. That's how our minds build. And what's another interesting one is, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the Holy Bible? I think of that classic leather black Bible that has the gold letters Holy Bible on the front of it. So we've already had this building, this whole concept of our visual learning. You know, and some other ones, because I love marketing so much, what's the first thing you think of when you think of a Kleenex? Well, you think of the tissue. Well, Kleenex is the name of the company, not the name of the product. But that's how marketing and advertisement has kind of worked with the way we learn to build a product base. So we see this used throughout our lives, these word and picture associations. So what I'm hoping today is we're going to go over 10 things in the Bible, and what I'm hoping is you don't have an image already in your mind that you can connect it to. So today we're going to build, hopefully, a new image in your mind for each of these words. So we're going to, and I'm going to go over these. So hopefully, maybe you already have an image of your mind, and hopefully not, so we can build off of this. So the first one we're going to cover is fig. And I know that somebody maybe already have an idea of what a fig is, but a lot of these images I got directly from either from the Israel area or the Egyptian area, that hopefully they are really accurate when it comes to what exactly we're going to build our mind and our image to. So we have fig, we have locusts, jot and tittle. We're actually going to learn a lot of Hebrew this morning, the actual handwriting of Hebrew. Winnowing, we have a wheat chaff, a yoke, an awl. I think I'm saying that right. It's a tool that's used. We're going to relate some verses with all these. A goad, a millstone, and baptism. We're going to relate each of these words, but we're going to define them out of the Bible, and we're going to have an image that goes along with it. So I know that's kind of a lot to think about, but when I start going through these, it's all hopefully going to piece together. So we're going to talk about figs here first, and this is in Matthew 21:18-19. It says, "Now the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry, and seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it but leaves. And he said to it, 'Let no fruit grow on you ever again.' Immediately the fig tree withered away." Okay, so we have this fig tree, and the person we're talking here is Jesus. He'd come to this fig tree. So, I don't know if you guys already have an image of what a fig is or what fig leaves are. But this is what a fig leaf is. So now when we read this verse, hopefully we can relay this image in our mind about what a fig leaf is. These are actual images from the trees in the area that probably where Jesus was at this time. And these are actually figs growing off the side here. So just think, Jesus came up to this tree, and there was nothing growing on it. There was no figs. There was nothing but the leaves. Then, I don't know if you guys know what a fig is, but here's a picture of a fig from this area. It looks like a really ripe fruit. And this is a fig. So hopefully now we have an image to relay with what fig's leaves look like and what a fig looks like. So now hopefully when you're reading the Bible, you can relate these images together because figs are actually commonly spoken on. Okay, so I think you guys kind of got the understanding of how this is set up. So let's now talk about the locusts. Now, we're all familiar with Exodus 10 and 12, where it talks about Moses stretching out his hand over the land of Egypt and the locusts that may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land, all that hail has left. So we know that they cast these locusts out. And here's what a locust looks like from this area. Now, it looks like our grasshopper. Kind of looks like what our regular grasshopper is, but these things are good size. I wanted to give a picture, kind of giving the perspective of how big this was, but this actually image came from a photographer in Egypt, so what better of an image to have up here, maybe one to keep in our mind, is what this image of what this locust looks like. And of course, we know how grasshoppers and everything and kind of eat up, you know, our land and stuff like that, so just imagine hundreds of thousands of these locusts. And their locusts have several stages to them. This is their final form of stage of this locust. And they're actually a good size. So hopefully we've built that in our mind. So now when we read through locusts, we have an image of our locusts. So I know that a lot of people have probably studied these things before, maybe already have these images in your mind. But one of the things that I like to study sometimes is actually the Hebrew writings of things. So we have in Matthew 5:18, we're going to talk about jot and tittle. "For surely I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass away from the law till all is fulfilled." All right, so what does that mean? We're going to be talking about a jot and a tittle. So if we actually look at how you write in Hebrew, here are our two examples. So a jot is this common mark, kind of looks like a quote. You see this little bottom half that hangs off is a jot. It's itty-bitty. And also the tittle is just this itty-bitty little bit off the top of this first mark. Those itty-bitty little marks can totally change the meaning in Hebrew. It's the way that the stroke is made. So I like to think of this verse that means not even a period will be pass away. I mean, that's how accurate everything is going to sustain throughout history. Not even one of these itty-bitty little changes will be made to the law until all is fulfilled. So we kind of see this mark and how this is written. So also, if you look at the Hebrew spelling of God, like the Lord God, there's a jot and tittle in here. So we have our jot and then tittle, because it's the top part right there. So we have these parts of this word that are even in the word God. And there's another couple phrases that we're going to be using that actually have jots and tittles in them. So hopefully as you're studying, you can use this to relay this in your memory about exactly what this looks like. Okay. Now hopefully we're on to our next part, and it's winnowing. I'm not sure if people have studied this before or have maybe seen this act. So let's look here in Matthew 3:11-13. I indeed baptize you with water unto repentance, but he who is coming after me is mightier than I. Those sandals I am not worthy to carry. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly clean out the threshing floor and gather his wheat into my mind ended on mine here, so threshing floor and gather his wheat into his barn, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenched fire. Okay. So we have this winnowing fan. So what exactly is the act of winnowing? Okay? So this is what winnowing is. And just to keep in mind, this man is using a winnowing fork. They have a winnowing fork and a winnowing fan. So when you take grain, when grain is fully ready to be harvested, if you throw it up in the air, the chaff will separate and the grain piece will fall straight down and the wind will carry the chaff away. So as this man is throwing this up in the air, these more dense dots are falling straight down, and where the rest of it is just blowing away. So he's separating the grain. So you could really relay this when this verse comes up, where it talks about this separation. You know, he is separating these two pieces together. So this kind of gives us an idea. And then a winnowing fan is a basket, basically, without an end on it. So you think of a square basket without an end. They would just scoop up the grain, throw it into the air, and then it would separate like this. So that's where our winnowing comes from. But also, let's look at this same verse, and let's talk about a wheat chaff. I have never really seen what a wheat chaff was, so I had no idea how to build this in my mind when you think of them doing this with a winnowing fan. So here's what a wheat chaff looks like. And now this is an image of wheat chaff from Israel. So it's interesting to look here at what this wheat chaff is. So you can see basically where the grain sat in here. It kind of looks like a piece of corn husk. So whenever they would throw the grain up in the air, this is kind of a light and flaky material. It would just blow away when the grain would fall straight down, because it was a denser thing. So I like to kind of take a look at this. We can now build our image in our mind of, we have these two things in this verse that maybe we didn't know of before, but now we've built our mind off of these new words. So, a yoke. Now, I know that we've had some farmers in here and people that have been around setting up horses or cattle or whatever, so yoke. But there also may be some people in here that don't know what the yoke is. So that's why I kind of threw this in here. And also, I like this verse because when we look at the yoke, this will be really important. So, Galatians 5:1, it says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage." Okay, so this is talking about being entangled with the yoke of bondage. Okay, so let's take a look at a yoke. Now, my grandpa used to have yokes hanging up in his barn and everything. So it's neat to think of what these yokes look like and what they were used for. They were used to yoke oxen, other farm animals together to pull plows. So you have two pulling at the same power. So as you can see, there's a place that they can actually hook the plow to, and it would be hooked to these two oxen. So when you put it in mind with this verse, now that we know what the yoke is, now that we have that image of what that yoke is in our mind, think of us in this yoke, and then you have bondage, something that's bound together. Try working against that. That's going to be very hard to do. Like, just imagine if one of these oxen were bound up and the other one wasn't. He's basically going to be trying to pull this whole time. So I thought that this verse was important when we look at the word yoke, so we can kind of put this in our mind. And then when we're reading, because yoke comes up several times, that we can kind of keep this act in our mind about the yoke. Okay. On to our next one. I think this is an all. I'm not exactly sure of the enunciation of this here. I'm definitely not the great at announcing names, or this is in particular is a tool. But I'm not sure if some of us are familiar with this verse. This is one of the few times that this word is actually used in the Bible. But here in Exodus 21, 5 through 6, it talks about, but if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then the master shall bring him to the judge, and he shall also bring him to the door, to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. So, some of the young kids here may remember the song Pierce My Ear in Camp. This is kind of where this verse is coming from. So, when you think of this and piercing your ear to a doorpost with this awl, and then when you see what it looks like, you can think of the painful, how painful it may be. During these time frames, I read that a lot of them were made out of wood and a lot of them were made out of bone. These tools could be used for several things, for hollowing out. Like if you were working on something, you would need to make a dent for like a nail or something like that. This is actually a tool woodworkers still use today. Of course, they look totally different. I tried to get the most historically accurate one that I could find. But yet again, it's an image of something we can keep in our mind. The ones mostly today kind of have like a round place you can hold your hand, and it's kind of a metal spike that just kind of comes out from it. You know, and you can use it for multiple things. But just think of in this time frame about, you know, nailing an ear to a doorpost with one of these. So at least now we have this image in our mind about what this is. So our next one is a goad. And this one I had, I have a couple supporting verses here. This one was kind of harder to find, but yet it's mentioned several times in the Bible. So in Judges 3 and 31 it says, after him was Samgar, the son of Athan, who killed 600 men and the Philistines with an axe, with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel. Okay? Then Acts 9, 4 through 6, and it says, and he said, who are you, Lord? When the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting, is it hard for you to kick against the goads? Okay. So now we have it kind of used in two different senses. Trying to find a goad from this time frame was fairly difficult, but yet they were used in several countries around this area. The only ones that I could really find were the ones from India. However, the ones that I read about are, from Egypt area. So this is actually an elephant goad. And the ones that I could find about an ox goad basically didn't have this point. They just had kind of like another arm coming out from it that came to a point going the different direction. So now when we think of Shamgar killing 600 people with one of these, it's almost like a spear or a sword. And now when we think of Saul at this point here in Acts 9-6, him kicking against this, this was kind of what was used to prod animals along, to kind of keep them going. So what I always think of, you know, this object, and then Jesus saying, you know, why are you kicking against me? You know, he's kind of prodding them along, and he's kicking back in this instance. That's why I thought maybe this image, with two different uses of it, we can kind of get an idea about the importance of word to image association. Okay? And a millstone. Now, I think of a lot of millstones. Millstones were actually used here in the United States for years, and we have mills and everything that you can actually go to these historical places and see these things. But hopefully I got a couple of images from towns around Galilee that these are actually still here. They're dated back to the first century. So just for an instance, I found the word millstone, and then I have it used here in Matthew 18:5-7. It says, whoever receives one little child in this, my name receives me. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Okay, so we're talking about a millstone. So let's take a look at some of these historical millstones. So this is a famous picture of a millstone that's outside of Galilee. That would have been about in this area, maybe about the time frame that even this was written. So this particular millstone, they said, was used to crush olives into like olive oil, where they would have been laid throughout this ring. And that millstone would have spun around because there would have been a device, you know, hooked to an animal and then through here and into this hole. So when the animal walked around, it would have spun the millstone around. So you think of the size of these millstones. These were huge. So now we have this picture of this millstone being hung around somebody's neck and then cast into the sea. These millstones were quite large, and you can see how much use this one's had. It's kind of wore down over the years. And here's a picture of a bigger one. This is outside of Gethsemane, and it's just a little bigger. So you can think of this millstone being hung around your neck and thrown into the sea. So now we kind of have this image recognition of this millstone, these really large, very heavy stones. You really wouldn't have a chance if it was wrapped around you and you were thrown into the sea. So now we kind of have that image recognition with these images we have here. So now we're to the last one that we're going to talk about today, and it's baptism. So what I tried to do here with breaking this down was to kind of give a few things, and we'll try to build an image from here. So we're going to talk about the Greek-Latin lexicon of the word. So it gives a primary meaning of the verb baptism, first person, and then we're back here to our Greek and our Hebrew writing here. If you can kind of see here, there's a jot and a tittle. It's kind of an odd angle here for me. So these down here are the jots and the tittles. Also, the word jot in this sense is also the same sense that we use like jot it down. You know, to make a small note. So I always thought that was interesting, with the use of these words. From which the English verb baptize is devised, a dip, plunge, and by giving example of the use of the Hebrew word baptism for plunging. So this is actually used throughout the Bible when talk about things falling into the water, either washing your hands, or talked about cleaning vessels or vases. Was actually to drop them completely, submerge into water. So here in Romans, we're going to read Romans 6:4. It says, therefore we are buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was risen from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we are also should walk in newness of life. So we see this act of baptism here in Romans 6:4, where it's talked about buried in to death. So we're buried with him through baptism. So when we have our kind of our definition here in our Greek, where it talks about plunging or submerged, I'm not sure what images you guys come to mind when you think of baptism right away. But let's also take a look here in 1 Peter. So we have 1 Peter 3:21. It says, there is also an antitype which saves us, baptism, not the removal of filth from the flesh, but an answer of good conscience towards God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Okay, so now we see this baptism, it's not a removal of filth from the flesh, but a good conscience towards God. So now we have the word plunge and submerged in with the same idea as, you know, not a removal of filth from the flesh. So we kind of have this whole image of being plunged. So, like I said, I'm not sure what image that you guys have maybe already had in your mind about baptism, but I searched through several images, and this is always a one that has always come to my mind. You can kind of see how this guy is just totally being submersed. He's completely been taken under. He's been plunged. Because when we were talking about our definition in the Greek lexicon, I'm not sure that it actually dates back to the 1500s to talk about the Greek and English conversion of text is actually where that definition came from. So when we talk about that word plunge, dip, or plunging into, this is what I think of, this total submersion in water. So to wrap it up this morning, I hope that I've kind of give everybody a good idea. Maybe you've never had an image of some of these things, or maybe haven't really thought about them too much. I tried to pick out things that we could all learn from, whether some of us have studied the Bible for years and years, or whether some of us are just now really starting to dive a little deeper into it. We can come up with these images in our mind that help us relate and read the Bible, and kind of help us build a better understanding of the things we're reading. But also today, I'd like to kind of extend the invitation where we're given these examples here in the Bible about, there's an antitype which saves us now, which is baptism. And we've kind of went over the words, and now we have what this idea is. So if you'd like to be baptized, please come forward as we stand and sing.
Have you a heart that's weary?